And joining us now on the phone from the Utah Avalanche Forecast Center with a look at the backcountry, Nikki. Good morning, Nikki.
Good morning. So the snow's kind of tapered off, but our storm totals are up to 16 to 21 inches in Upper Big and Little Cottonwood Canyon, and up to 16 inches on the Park City Ridgeline. Yesterday, there were 6 new avalanches reported in the backcountry. 2 that were very notable were Powder Park and the Tri Chutes. Both of those ran in the early season facets or near the ground. Those are both on northwest or west aspects above 9,000 feet. The 2 main issues today are going to be that persistent weak layer we keep talking about, the avalanches at Powder Park and the Tri Chutes that broke in that old weak snow near the ground, prove that the significant snowfall over the past few days has overloaded our existing weak snowpack. We can expect avalanches to be 2 to 4 feet deep, and if caught, probably unsurvivable. So if you choose to ride slopes deeper than 30 degrees, where that weak snow exists, you're likely to trigger an avalanche. The other issue is the new snow. So this new snow fell on a bunch of weak surfaces, buried surface hoar, near surface facets. Regardless of what you call it, it's weak. The new storm snow is going to be our slab. Even though the slab hasn't been very uniform or cohesive, the new snow avalanches still may be triggered on all aspects and elevations. As well, any new snow avalanches triggered can step down deeper into the weaker layers, creating a much larger avalanche 2 to 4 feet deep. Today, the avalanche danger is going to be considerable on all steep slopes at upper elevations and considerable on mid-elevation slopes facing west through north through east. We have very dangerous avalanche conditions. Conservative decision-making is going to be essential. Low angle terrain is our only option. And down in the Provost Mountains, we do have a higher avalanche danger. They got more water and had a shallower snowpack, so there's going to be a high avalanche danger down there.
Okay, Nikki, thank you. KPCW News Time now, 8:09. Good morning. Well, stay tuned. Coming up, we're scheduled to talk with Park City School Board President Aaron Grady and Business Administrator Todd Hauber. Later on, U.S. Ski and Snowboard Update with Communications Manager Laura Carlton. And finally, blind skier and motivational speaker Chad Foster talking about his day on the slopes at Deer Valley on Friday. Also be hearing from Tracy Meyer with the National Ability Center with details on the 32nd annual Huntsman Cup. Well, during the first week of the Utah's 45-day legislative session, Utah Governor gave a State of the State address which covered key issues throughout the state. KPCW's Jessica Lowell has a recap of that speech.
Utah Governor Spencer Cox addressed the House and the Senate jointly last Thursday for his first State of the State address. While Cox laid out plans to deal with concerns about public infrastructure and transportation, his address largely focused on education throughout the state. He said the legislature is working to expand education funding, which includes more than $100 million in bonuses for teachers.
They deserve our respect, and they deserve a raise. I'm grateful to you legislators who agree and have pledged historic education funding this year. And while I just referred to these investments as historic, I'm looking forward to them becoming routine.
Cox also addressed concerns over education inequality throughout the state. He said while education is supposed to act as an equalizer, rural and minority communities do not have the same access to education.
I truly believe that this concept of educational equity is at the heart of so much of the pain and division in our country right now. A high-quality education can change everything.
By creating a more equal education system, he says it can also help to fix intergenerational poverty. Cox also took issue with what he described as, quote, contempt, tribalism, and discord over the last few weeks.
Now, that of course does not mean that we should never disagree. I'm going to veto some of your bills, probably more than my predecessors. Please don't take it personally. There must be no room for contempt or hate. We are friends. We must always be friends.
In response to Cox's address, Utah's Democratic Senate and House members called on the governor to address accessibility to online learning, as well as ensuring COVID-19 vaccines for all residents. They also brought up concerns over systematic racism and environmental issues. In the response, House Minority Leader Brian King said he hopes to work with Republicans to address these issues.
We see a lot of areas where we can work together across the aisle to solve some of Utah's biggest challenges, like housing affordability, air quality, climate change, and police reform. We're not interested in political posturing or divisiveness. We're here as public servants to solve problems and to get things done so that all Utahns have their own opportunities to thrive.
Bills concerning education, police reform, climate change, and housing affordability are making their way through the legislative session. Jessica Lowell, KPCW News.
Well, the Park City Board of Education last week agreed to a $6 million land purchase for property adjacent to US 40 near the Round Valley Trailside Trailhead. The school board also approved a contract with Mocha Consultants to assist the district in working through its master plan and heard a presentation from the PC CAP students. On the phone with details, I have Park City School Board President Aaron Grady along with Business Administrator Todd Hauber. Good morning to both of you.
Good morning.
Good morning, Leslie.
Hey, just maybe quickly a reaction to the governor's State of the State address. Sounds like good news for education, at least from the governor's perspective. Aaron?
Absolutely. It's great to see that he is proactive in wanting to further education and getting money put into that area and for our teachers.
And Todd, have you seen anything at the legislature at this point that would be indicative of his pledge?
Definitely. The base budget bill that went out had most of the provisions he included in his budget. So the legislature and the governor are definitely on the same page as far as supporting financially the education system.
All right. Well, let's move to the decision by the board to purchase about 56 acres of property there in Highland Estates for $6 million. Todd, does that come out of the money for that come out of the capital fund?
It does, yeah. So we've had a reserve in the capital fund of hovering around $20 million probably for the last 4 or 5 years. And those are the monies that we had set aside with a long-term view of looking for property for the district, knowing that many of the forecasts looking out to 2060 showed our community area almost doubling in population.
Yeah, so Aaron, the property, some 55-plus acres, that's large enough for a high school. We've kind of used that 50-acre as a high school size. The real estate contract says the property will be used for school facilities or workforce housing. So what's the school board thinking at this point?
Right now, we're just trying to think into the future and land bank at this point. You know, I think there's very few parcels of land with that size left in the area, and it's definitely something we are just trying to think into the future and make sure that we have some land bank and set aside for the district.
Within the school district boundaries, yeah.
Absolutely.
Is there a possibility the property could change the overall master planning concept that the community's worked to develop these past several years?
It's part of that. So, no, absolutely not. You know, we've tried to keep the public in part of the process the entire time, and they will continue to be a part of the process as we move forward. Again, this is even something that is pushing out as far as like 2060 with our strategic planning and just making sure we're really looking into the future for our district.
Yeah. So, I mean, I understand that it makes sense that property negotiations are done behind closed doors to negotiate the best price. At what point is the public's role in terms of giving input when it comes down to an actual decision? This was just approved, and it didn't look like there were any opportunities to give feedback on the school board's decision.
So right now, and Todd, feel free to jump in, we are just going into due diligence right now at this time, and that is, I believe, the proper way for us to move forward in how we have to as a governing board with the land purchase.
So the sale went through, or because usually due diligence.
No, Todd, I'll let Todd answer.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so right now we just have the purchase and sales agreement. So it spells out the terms upon which we would go into closing. We're in the due diligence period now in which we will more thoroughly inspect the property to make sure that it's appropriate for school use moving into the future. So we have 45 days to determine whether the parcel is appropriate. And then we would move into closing at that point.
And speaking with Summit County Community Development or Pat Putt, it sounds like absolutely it's available for school use. It sounds like if the district wanted to use it for workforce housing, that could be a little bit more, I guess, just work problematic. Is that a consideration, though, or is it really school use?
Yeah, so we had several conversations with the county to make sure that we understood what the future potential of the property was. And that's right, when talking with Pat Putt, it was clear that under a special permit, we would be able to use the property for school purposes. But the underlying zoning is still there. So if we were to talk about workforce housing or affordable housing on the property, we would be like any other property owner or developer and have to go through the county process to seek a zoning change and allow for any variances on the property.
Yeah. And why would that make sense, though, to do workforce housing?
Right now, we're seeing that about 35% of our employees are commuting into the community to work for the school district. And we anticipate that that number will only increase in time. And recognizing that there's not enough inventory of affordable housing for our employees, we feel that we might have to at some point step in and help in that situation so that we can have our employees here living within the community, which the board values.
So as a business administrator, it sounds like you advise the board, I mean, to go ahead and purchase the property, I mean, and consider it like an investment like you did with the home that was purchased for the superintendent?
Sure. Yeah, and it's and as Aaron mentioned, it really is a land banking strategy. I've been looking for parcels of land since 2014. And every time we get close to a parcel that's large enough, someone with more money comes in and snatches it up, or it gets repurposed in some other way. So we were able to work with the owner on this one and actually take something that was much higher on the market and get down to a price that a school district could afford and be able to plan for the future.
All right. Well, last week's consent agenda also included a decision to approve a contract with the firm MOCA. My understanding is that we've got a complete master plan. So what's MOCA doing for the school district at that $100,000 contract?
Sure. Perfect question. The we need to now take what MHTN had presented to the board back in spring and into the summer, which was several options. So there, I think there were three total options that had multiple phasing. We need to have those community conversations to say, of these three options, which is the go-for-it option and which phasing seems most appropriate under that option, so that we can make sure we have the schools looking the way the community wants them, and we can also start to lay out the financing strategy. So MOCA will, for the first part, walk us through those conversations. And then their primary role is, once we have those projects identified under those options and phasing, they will then be the taskmaster, if you will, and work with us to get an architect on board and get a general contractor on board and execute those projects under budget.
So is it fair to say they're kind of a project manager here as opposed
Absolutely.
To like a PR firm?
Correct. They are... Their main course is to be that construction project manager. We will need to bring on board that PR piece along the way.
Yeah. So, I mean, at this point, I mean, is it a foregone conclusion that the capital projects outlined will happen under that master plan?
Sure. I think that one of the options and its accompanying phasing will be adopted. We do need to move forward. We need to update our buildings. We need to move that ninth grade into the high school to complete that experience for our students. So there are some need to things out there. We also have oversubscriptions for preschool services. So we need to really start moving on these projects.
So what's the timeline here?
So depending again on which option and phasing, the timelines run 3 years to 5 years.
All right. And I guess what's the timeline in terms of MOCA getting this, if the community is making some decisions here? I mean,
yep.
What's...
Yep. So we'll spend the latter end of winter here into spring to get those community conversations underway. We still have to figure out how to do that in the COVID environment, so we want to make sure we're not stepping on our toes or stumbling as we try to have those conversations with COVID restrictions, but we'll figure that out. And then come spring and into summer, we'll be looking to put the contracts out for architects and general contractors.
All right. And it sounds like there could be a bond on November's ballot. Is that part of this plan?
That is a possibility. So we included that in the MOCA contract. Again, it depends on which of those projects come out of that community conversation and which financing supports the scheduling of those projects. And so a general obligation bond is definitely in the considerations.
Well, because the district has also taken the steps necessary to go the lease revenue bonds route. So is that still being considered, or?
Yeah, so that,
I think,
that's
Leslie,
on,
we're trying to make
table,
sure that we have right. all of our options on the table. And so I think everything is kind of being considered right now. And as everything kind of lines up and making sure that we take the district into the best direction moving forward, depending on how we handle that.
All right. Did you want to add to that, Todd?
Nope. Aaron answered just what I was going to say.
Okay. So we should expect to start seeing some of these meetings happen here shortly with some kind of plan by this summer.
That is our goal.
Yep, that's the goal.
All right. Let's see. PCCAP students presented a sustainability plan asking the school district to approve and implement it covered. Boy, it was pretty wide-reaching. Energy, waste, water, land, air quality, transportation. They also submitted a timeline. Aaron, does the board now consider making this a permanent program as we move through these upcoming capital projects?
So first off, I have to say congratulations to those students. They were amazing. It's so wonderful to have them come in front of the board and see all the amazing things that they're accomplishing. It is something that we are considering. They sent us their full plan 2 days after our meeting. So the board is all taking time to kind of go through all of that. We're going to meet with the district too to make sure it's in line. But of course, sustainability in our community as a district and as a board is very important to us, so we'll make sure that we're working with them and aligning it as we move forward.
Yeah, I mean, they went from solar, geothermal, heat pump options, electric school buses. I mean, they were, like I say, pretty wide-ranging. I mean, Todd, what are your thoughts, I guess, on the feasibility of pursuing this?
So it's, I think on one level, it's very ambitious to accomplish all of the recommendations that show up on the work that they've done. As a district, we've made forays into different parts of different recommendations they've had. So back in 2017, when we were working on a master plan at that time, we had gone out and did geothermal testing at all of the district's properties, just to see if that strategy could play out at any of the schools that we currently have. So we've made forays into those areas, but it'll be exciting to see which ones come together. We even tasked MHTN at the tail end of the last part of the master planning to look at each of our buildings and to cost estimate what it would be to bring the school facilities up to the Park City standard that they had set for 2030. So we have some cost estimates on what that could look like as well. So it'll be good to bring all the different ideas together and see what's feasible.
Okay. I have to admit, note that KPCW was extremely excited to see that the school board had moved its meetings to a Zoom platform. But after tuning in last Tuesday, I mean, it's still less than desired. And I guess what's the problem here? I mean, all of the school board folks were meeting in the room, and I think the whole idea was to have you all at your own laptops and have the meeting recorded so that everybody could be seen and heard. And that's not what happened on Tuesday. You want to take that, Aaron?
Well, it's hard. I didn't realize I could see some of the glitches happening, but understanding, I know that we did have some glitches, and it's something that we are working on, and I know Todd and Lori have been working on, but we did have a full recording that, not as far as video, but as far as the voice recordings are on our district website.
So are we going to, Todd, are we going to figure this out? I mean, are we going to, again, I mean, the Park City, Summit County, Wasatch County School Board, they're all able to make this work so that you can actually see and hear and actually and also have a recording.
Yeah, no, I think there's a couple of values that we're trying to bring together, and we may not have mastered that at this point. But one of the values is that our schools are in person, and we've made every effort to make those appropriate places for education to take place, to be safe places for that to take place. And it's very symbolic to have our board also meeting in person. That is just in concert with the goals and values that we had set for the education system as a whole. So our challenge will be to try and find the right format that will allow that value to play out as we have these conversations in front of the public with our board meetings.
Yeah, but I guess some people are asking, is it safe for you guys all to be in the same room there?
I'm sure there's going to be those questions. We have those questions even in the classrooms as well. And we're doing our best to mitigate. And I think we've struck a pretty good balance at this point.
Okay. And then, Aaron, you were voted in as president. Who's serving as vice president?
Wendy Crossland will be serving as the vice president.
Okay. Anything else you guys wanted to mention?
Nope. Thank you. Oh, we are into our test to stay program, and there are, if families today, it's free to the community members at Eccles can test for free today between 9 and 3 and tomorrow between 12 and 7.
Right. And then all of the other students actually move back into the high school and Treasure Mountain today?
Yep, they are getting tested today.
Okay. All right, Aaron, Todd, thanks so much for your time.
Thanks,
Leslie.
Well, on the phone now with an update from U.S. Ski and Snowboard, I have Communications Manager Laura Carlton. Good morning, Laura.
Good morning, Leslie.
So let's start with the Alpine, and of course, we had the Hahnenkamm happening.
Yes, it was the 81st edition of that event. Due to COVID-19, there were no spectators, which was definitely a notable change considering it normally draws crowds of 80,000 people, definitely known as the Super Bowl on the ski racing circuit. The Americans were strong in both training runs, and Ryan Cochran-Siegel was a favorite to win our podium. He was having a great run on race day on Friday before he got a little back and went through the net. He is okay. He was airlifted per Kitzbühel's protocols. He sustained a minor cervical spine fracture, so he's sidelined for the time being. He was having a great season. He had his first podium in the downhill in Val Gardena in second and a victory in Bormio, Italy in the Super G. Ryan is staying positive, and he's hoping for an end-of-season return. He was able to watch the downhill on Sunday and catch up with his teammates and cheer everyone on, but there's no timeline yet as of when he may return to competition. So we're sending good vibes to Ryan and his family as he works through this.
Oh my gosh, that's what you just hate to see, though. I mean, that is like that close to, you know, being as minor cervical fracture and never walking again.
Yeah, so very fortunate that he is okay and able to walk and walked away from the injury and from the venue. So very fortunate. Yeah. We're very thankful that it ended in the best case scenario in that instance.
Okay. And then you did have some that completed the course.
Yes. Friday, you know, it was a very challenging day. There were long course holes due to weather conditions and other crashes. Three of the remaining athletes that started, Travis Ganon, Bryce Bennett, and Salt Lake's Jared Goldberg, did score in the points. Travis ended up 11th, Jared was 19th, and Bryce was 24th. Unfortunately, weather came in and the second downhill was pushed from Saturday to Sunday. So the second downhill on Sunday was another tough day for the Americans. Travis ended up 12th and Jared was 24th. Following the race, Jared was commenting on the cancellation of the Wengen series, was challenging for the team. There wasn't momentum coming from Wengen to Kitzbühel. And on today's rescheduled Super G, Travis was the leading U.S. member, finishing 27th. Jared Goldberg also finished in the points in 30th. So it was a challenging weekend for our men in Austria. But up next for the men is the night slalom in Schladming on Tuesday, and then the crew heads to Chamonix, France, for two more slaloms this weekend.
Okay. And the women?
The women were in Crans-Montana for Switzerland for a speed series this weekend, and Breezy Johnson grabbed another third place finish, making it her fourth for four third place finishes in downhill. On Saturday, it appeared she was going to back it up with another podium. She ended up fifth, but her consistency has been incredible and amazing to watch, considering coming back from back-to-back injuries the past few seasons. And she's looking forward to competing in one of her favorite tracks in Garmisch, Germany next weekend. Bella Wright from Salt Lake City scored another career best result. She was 20th in Friday's downhill. She followed it up with a 25th on Saturday and a 28th on Sunday. So she scored in all five of the five last races. And up next, the women are skiing a giant slalom in Italy before a speed series in Garmisch, Germany this weekend.
Okay, and cross country?
Cross country was in, competing in Finland for the skiathlon. On Saturday, Jesse Diggins was fifth. Park City local Rosie Brennan was eighth. And on the men, Gus Schumacher was 18th and Scott Patterson was 22nd. Sunday had a team relay, and the U.S. women's team of Rosie, Jesse, Sophia Lockley, and Caitlin Patterson finished fifth. On the men's side, Gus, Hunter Wonders, David Norris, and Scott Patterson were seventh. Cross country heads next to Sweden for freestyle and classic distance events and a classic sprint. Heading into next weekend's events, Diggins, Jesse, and Rosie are currently still 1-2 in the overall World Cup standings and the World Cup distance standings. So still a lot of momentum coming off that Tour de Ski. That event is a beast and really, you know, a tiring thing to get through. So seeing some good results this weekend was really exciting.
Okay. And freestyle?
Yes, freestyle. So Moguls continues to train at Steamboat. Part of the team will be in Winter Park for U.S. selections this week, January 27th and 28th, which helps determine domestic World Cup spots. But Aerials had another incredible weekend on the road. They were competing in the Moscow City World Cup event. This was the 11th edition that event was hosted. It's a pretty iconic venue with city views under the lights. Winter Vinecki claimed her first World Cup podium with a win. She nailed her double in, which is a double full, and that is three twists, two flips, scoring 94.11 points, and she beat out the competition, including the World Cup leader Laura Peel from Australia, who competes off the triple. So it was a really beautiful jump. It was really nice to see Winter with that result. She's had seven top six finishes previous to the event. She's overcome several injuries and is still committed to her Olympic dream. So we're really thrilled to see that result for Winter. It's been a long time coming. And Chris Lillis had his first podium of the season with a second place finish. This is his fourth World Cup podium of his career. And he had a bit of a rough start this season, not getting what he wanted to get accomplished in Ruka, Finland in the opener, and then was unable to compete last weekend from injury. So he was stoked to get back on the podium this weekend. Up next, the team is competing in Minsk, Belarus on Saturday before they come back stateside for the Deer Valley events.
Okay, and then free ski and snowboard.
Yes, we had the 2021 LAX Open and featuring halfpipe competition for snowboard competition for halfpipe and slopestyle. Chloe Kim made her return after 22 months from competition. She took off last season to attend school at Princeton full time, but she did not skip a beat. She is the defending Olympic and World Cup and world champion, of course, claiming clutch on Saturday in her final run to take the win. And this is her third LAX Open title. This also marks eight World Cup halfpipe wins for her in 12 starts. So just really awesome to see her back doing her thing. On Thursday, Jamie Anderson earned her fifth LAX Open title. This is her seventh World Cup slopestyle win in 11 starts, and it also marks nine slopestyle wins for a U.S. rider at the Open since 2002. Jamie, at 30 years old, considered a veteran in the field, she is not stopping or slowing down at all. So really incredible weekend for that crew. And then we also had our first event for the snowboard cross team kicked off in Italy. They had two races, and we had some great results there as well. on Saturday. Three-time Olympian and Salt Lake City local Faye Gallini earned her third World Cup podium, and she finished second place. This is her 14th season competing on the World Cup, so she had great starts out of the gate and kept in the front of the pack throughout the weekend. On Sunday, she followed that up with a second podium, finishing in second place. And Salt Lake City native, Hagan Kearney earned his first season podium with a third place. So really good momentum coming off the snowboard cross team. And up next for free ski and snowboard team members, they are preparing for X Games Aspen, which is set to take place this week in Buttermilk in Aspen, Colorado. And yeah, so lots of teams competing. It was a full event weekend for our whole organization, and really excited to keep seeing those results coming through.
Okay, Laura, thanks for your time.
Thank you so much.
Well, the Utah Legislature will resume in-person public participation beginning today for the first week of the 45-day session. The state capitol was closed to members of the public. All hearings and floor debate had to be watched online. To reopen to the public, COVID-19 safety procedures will be in place throughout the capitol complex. Wearing a mask and physical distancing will be required by all those who plan to visit the state capitol. Due to COVID-19 protocols, space will be limited in committee rooms. Because of this, a virtual option will continue to be made available, and state officials are encouraging it. In a statement, Senate President Stuart Adams said, quote, "The health and safety of all Utahns remain our number one priority as we accommodate in-person attendance at the Capitol. Public input is essential in maintaining the legislative process, and steps," he said, "were quickly taken to ensure an in-person public participation." He hopes that Utahns will continue to provide their feedback virtually or in person. Utah Highway Patrol will be stationed at each of the four public entrances at the Capitol to conduct bag checks. UHP will also have an active presence and provide security for each committee meeting to protect the public, staff, and elected officials. House Speaker Brad Wilson said while they initially allowed for virtual public participation, they look forward to the public rejoining lawmakers in person. He said they'll continue to adapt to whatever is thrown their way. Lawmakers and staff are required to take rapid COVID tests twice a week, hoping that will protect them from outbreaks. However, to respect the privacy of staff and lawmakers, the state will not be releasing the numbers of positive COVID-19 tests or to give out specific names. Individuals who need to be informed to prevent the spread of the virus will be notified. The public can access all committee meetings and legislative floor debates on the legislative website. You can view information regarding how to participate virtually on our website, kpcw.org. Well, at last week's Park City Planning Commission meeting, transit circulation and new architectural designs were the sole topic of discussion. KPCW's Sean Higgins has more on the difficulty of figuring out a solution for the area's already congested roads.
At Wednesday night's Park City Planning Commission meeting, city staff laid out what they called a transit-first philosophy for the proposed base development project at Park City Mountain Resort. Staff presented a pair of options for traffic and bus circulation around the construction, one above ground with dedicated bus lanes, and another with a significant portion of the bus traffic rerouted underground. The developer of the project, PEG Companies, favors the above ground option and says it presents the most practical and financially feasible of the two. Although taking buses off of surface streets would free up space for cars, routing buses underground is costly, and the plan would require bus stops at the base area to be moved. Critics say the current transit plans, as well as the various architectural designs, do not adhere to the original 1998 master plan, which governs the project. PEG is currently asking for exceptions to some of those requirements, like building heights and setback limitations. The hang-up stems from language in the current code that does not explicitly define what architectural variation means. PEG argues that because of the vagueness of the language, the decisions on what is and is not allowed for construction is ultimately up to the Planning Commission to decide, says PEG planning consultant Stan Kozlowski.
It is not specific relative to what the variation means. So we've been all along trying to take input, take community input, and try to create a building that takes into account everything with what we think are little to minor asks to those, you know, those pink and green and beige lines you saw last night relative to setbacks and volumetrics. You know, obviously 1998 was a long time ago, so we're trying to balance the two things relative to the also current neighborhood.
Despite the input and public meeting, some critics are still not satisfied with the plans as they are currently proposed. Nicole DeForge spoke on behalf of the Responsible Resort Area Development Coalition Community Group and said the project is taking a design-first, transit-later approach.
We wholeheartedly endorse this idea of transit-first, and that needs to be guiding the design and the development rather than being dictated by the design and the development. It feels like the plans that we're looking at are really more of a secondary consideration, that the developer has designed first, and then based on that design is trying to fix sort of the transit and transportation mess that's created by that design.
Getting in and out of the resort area of downtown Park City on a crowded winter day can routinely take a half hour or more. One possible solution suggested by city staff was to move underground parking off-site and take advantage of a more robust busing system to take guests to and from the mountain. In theory, this sounds like a simple solution, but PEG Vice President of Development Robert Schmidt says the company does not control any land outside of the base area. Any off-site solutions would require significant cooperation from the city.
Well, I think there's going to be continued conversations on that. The fact of the matter is that PEG Development, PEG companies, you know, we only control land at the base here at Park City Mountain Resort, so we don't have options to move it off-site.
PEG's current underground parking plans would charge for day parking, something Schmidt says will also help alleviate congestion at the mountain. Schmidt says PEG is targeting an April date for a decision from the Planning Commission on the project and would break ground soon after. The next two Planning Commission meetings to discuss the base development project are tentatively scheduled for February and March 17th. Sean Higgins, KPCW News.
Chad Foster, a blind tech executive and author of a new book, Blind Ambition, How to Go from Victim to Visionary, hit the slopes at Deer Valley last Friday. He was joined with a guide, an instructor from the National Ability Center, along with the NAC Program and Education Director, Tracy Meyer. Both Chad and Tracy join me now on the phone. Good morning.
Good morning, Leslie.
So, Chad, let's start with you. Are you a skier? You've done this before?
I am now. Yeah, not before. So I lost my eyesight in my early 20s and never tried to ski until afterwards. I was 38 years old the first time I put on a pair of skis, and so now I've got the itch for it. I fell in love with it, and yeah, now I ski as often as I can.
Wow, and I'm one of those people who has a really hard time in what we call flat light. We often say, oh, we're skiing blind, even though we're really not, but I mean, I get really nervous and very concerned when I can't see the terrain. And I know this is the wrong word, but I mean, what are you looking for? I mean, as a blind skier, when you don't know what's in front of you?
Well, I think actually it might give me a bit of an advantage of not being able to see in some regards, because I've often had ski instructors tell me that I'm able to do more terrain more quickly than some of their sighted students. And some of that's because I'm not overwhelmed with the fear and anxiety of what's around me. And so instead of being distracted by all of the dangers around me and then the intimidating view in front of me, I'm just focused on executing the next maneuver. I'm just focused on the next left turn or the next right turn.
Well, tell us how that works. Because I saw some video footage, and you weren't tethered. You did have somebody, though, behind you, I think, directing you?
Yeah, that's exactly how it works. So we both wear Bluetooth earpieces in our helmets, and the guide skis behind me anywhere from 20 to 30 feet, depending on which terrain we're on. If we're on a catwalk and it's really tight and we're going really slowly, then obviously they'll ski very close to me. If we're on a black run or something steep, then they'll be skiing with a little more distance between us. But essentially, they'll be telling me which direction to turn, whether that be a left or a right, a slight left or a slight right, or a hard left or a hard right, and whether or not to accelerate or to slow down.
Yeah. So were you skiing, though, with other people on the slope?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And that, you know, obviously we were there this last week, part of the Martin Luther King Day weekend, and it was pretty busy out there. So a little bit harder to open it up, had to be a little more careful and just aware with all the traffic out there. Obviously, we would prefer to be on a slope with fewer people, because I don't mind skiing the terrain and the pitch, but moving obstacles, you know, people with differing levels of awareness and differing levels of ability make it somewhat challenging navigating in those dense crowds. But definitely we would prefer to have no people out there, but know that that's just not a practical reality.
Yeah. It was snowing on Friday. Did that make it any more challenging than it already is?
And I thought it was great. It was wonderful to have some powder out there. We were waiting all week and hoping. I did my snow dance several times before coming out this last week, and evidently it finally paid off because, as you're right, you're absolutely spot on Friday. We started snowing, probably around 11 or 12 local time there on Park City Mountain, and it was great. It was nice to have some fresh powder.
Yeah. So did you come to Park City just to ski, or did you have other business here?
No, it was just the ski. That was our getaway. It was a daddy-daughter trip, so I started taking my daughter out there last year. She fell in love with it like I have as well. And so it was a daddy-daughter trip, and my friend, whom I've been skiing with for the last 6 years, I'm a friend. We're very close friends. We've known each other for over 30 years. He also guides me as well at times, and so he brought his daughters out, and we made it a daddy-daughter getaway out there, which we're now doing every year.
All right. So have you worked with the National Ability Center, though, prior to this?
I did. Yeah, I worked with them last year, and it's a fantastic program. I just honestly did not know what I was missing until the first time I tried it. They have a fantastic program, not being tethered, as you mentioned earlier, to someone on the mountain. You know, I'm normally tethered to my guide dog. I have a German Shepherd guide dog who now guides me around, and usually I'm tethered to my guide dog or someone, and being out on the mountain, it's just a really thrilling experience having that level of freedom out there. So it's pretty irreplaceable, and it's finally given me a feeling that I've not had in quite some time. You know, as I mentioned earlier, I went blind a little bit later in life, and so I played competitive sports, and you know, as much as I enjoy going to the gym and working out, which I do 6 or 7 days a week, it's not the same as playing a sport like getting out there on the mountain. So it helps to really fill a void that I haven't had the opportunity to do in quite some time.
Yeah. So as I mentioned, you've got a new book out, Blind Ambition, How to Go from Victim to Visionary. You didn't do any book signings or anything like that then while you were here?
No, I did not. The book is going to be officially released February the 16th. And we're publishing in partnership with HarperCollins Leadership. Right now we have a special going where if people pre-order the book, they get a free audio book as well. So it's not on shelves yet, but if people pre-order now, then they can get free access to the audio book as well.
All right. And can you just kind of give us the Reader's Digest version of it?
Yeah. So the net of it is going blind at the age of 20, more or less. It was a bit of a slow process that occurred over a few years. I've learned a lot over the course of my life. I'm actually happier now, and I'm more successful now than when I could see. And I had to learn a lot about myself. I had to learn a lot about my self-identity, my fears, overcoming those fears. I had to learn how to cultivate resilience. I had to learn how to reinvent myself, and I had to learn how to deal with all of the fears and insecurities that accompany the loss of one's self-identity and ideals for your future self. And so the book is really the story of how I was able to navigate that while in college and emerge stronger and better than before. And so what I hope to accomplish with the book is teach other people how to nurture resilience in their own lives so that they can emerge from the adversity that gets presented us all and emerge happier and stronger than ever.
All right. Now, Tracy, you are the Program and Education Director with National Ability Center. Were you out on the slopes then Friday as well?
I was out on the slopes, and I actually checked Chad in for our health check in our new world of COVID. So, yes, I enjoyed the snow as well.
Yeah. So any idea of the thousands of lessons that you do every winter are for blind skiers? I mean, is that, how does that compare with, say, the amputees or, folks like that?
Yeah, you know, we serve such a wide variety, Leslie, with 30% usually falling on the autism spectrum and 30% being our veterans, those who have served our country and kind of everything in between. I'd say it's a smaller percentage, but we have a great relationship with a local group who are young kiddos who are blind and visually impaired. And so I think Chad hit on so many great points of that perception of independence and freedom and inclusion and connection that comes from sports and recreation. And so we love to share that with everyone who can come out and join us.
Okay. Well, the Huntsman Cup is coming up this week, and it's, gosh, hard to believe, the 32nd annual.
Yeah.
And again, this is for athletes who not only compete with National Ability Center, but I think worldwide, yeah?
That's right, Leslie. Yeah, 32 years, and we're excited to be able to run this in our current situation of the world. We have 36 athletes planning to be here from mostly from the U.S., but Israel and Chile as well are going to be represented. And this event is so important for preparation for 2022. So you're going to see athletes like Chad that you heard about who are visually impaired or blind, and then those that have other physical disabilities out there getting prepared and enjoying this opportunity to get ready for additional races.
Yeah, so how many athletes you got competing then?
We'll have 36 right now is what we have on the books for the Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday of this week.
Okay, at Park City, is that where you're doing it?
Yes, we are really excited to be over on the Eagle Race Arena. So where the 2002 GS events were is where our athletes will be competing.
That's the steep side of the mountain, yeah. My gosh.
That's right, yep. Expect more, right? Chad just told you, just because you have a disability doesn't mean you can't do what everyone else should do, and so we're putting them on the big hill.
Okay. And then in terms of precautions that you're taking due to COVID, I mean, are spectators allowed, or how are you working that?
Yeah, thanks, Leslie. You know, we have put in a lot of protocols and worked with our awesome partner, Vail. And so face coverings are required for all of our athletes and coaches. Health checks will be in place, and then physical distancing. But we encourage you to come out and cheer on the athletes. You can watch from the chairlift or wherever else. But it'll be all about racing this year.
Okay. So, Chad, any interest in racing? Is that something you've going to add to your list?
You know, it actually sounds kind of fun. It actually sounds very fun. So I need to get more information on that.
Yeah. Okay. Anything else, Chad, you'd like to mention?
You know, I think people are coming out of a very difficult year, the year that we've all had and are still in right now with COVID. And, you know, whether it be the pandemic or some of the economic disruption that has taken place. And so one of the things that I've found throughout my journey is it's very important for people to control the narrative in their mind. The stories that we tell ourselves can either limit us or they can propel us towards our goals. And so a lot of times people will start telling themselves stories that aren't so productive about the current situation. And that could be about going blind. It could be about COVID. It could be about the disruption that we've all experienced. And it could also be about the year ahead of us. So I think, from my point of view and what I've experienced in my own life, you know, the key to emerging from any adversity stronger than before is first and foremost making sure that we control the narrative in our minds, because we can either tell ourselves a story that limits us or one that actually carries us forward. So I know that we're all facing that disruption right now, as we've talked about COVID limitations. So just bearing that in mind for listeners, so
okay,
that we can all have a better 2021 than we had last year.
All right. Well, Chad Foster, congratulations on the book, and hope to see you again in Park City. Tracy, thank you also as well. People can get more information at the website on the...
Yes, discovernac.org.
Okay. Thanks again, guys.